Hey, Scope Podcast listeners, Lindsay here. We just wanted to say thanks for listening to our shows. We hope you're nerding out as much as we are. Before we get to today's interview, I wanted to let you know that this episode is sponsored in part by Audible.com. And if you listen to other podcasts, you know what that means. Go to audibletrial.com/scopepodcast and you can sign up for a free 30-day trial and get a free audiobook download of your choice. Moomoo and I could talk your ear off about which book you should pick, but you already listened to us talk enough already. Choose an audiobook instead. audibletrial.com/scopepodcast. And now, on with the show.
Hi, I'm Mumushu.
And I'm Lindsay Claiborne, and you're listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Today's guest is Professor Julie Meachin. She is a vertebrate paleontologist and an assistant professor of anatomy at Des Moines University. Hi, Julie. Thanks so much for being on our show.
Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, our first question that we always start off with is, what is it that you do?
Well, that's a good question. I do a lot of things. But the thing that I do that I'm probably the most excited about is I am a vertebrate paleontologist. So I look at dead animals and try to figure out what they were doing.
And how, I mean, how dead? Like last week or like centuries
like really
or millennia
dead.
Ago?
like thousands of years dead. So the critters that I study were alive between about a million years ago until about 11,000 years ago.
And what kind of creatures or animals are we talking about?
I really like the mammals that have big teeth and claws. So I really specialize in big carnivorous mammals, ice age carnivorous mammals, you could say.
Like saber-toothed tigers?
Yeah, like saber-toothed tigers, only we actually call them saber-toothed cats. We don't call them saber-toothed tigers.
Oh, never again.
Is that politically incorrect now?
Yeah, no, well, it's not politically incorrect. It's just technically incorrect because they're not related to tigers. They're just big cats.
Where did that come from then?
I don't know. That's a good question. I really don't know why they started calling them tigers.
Why have we been doing it wrong for so long?
Because the Power Rangers, I'm just telling you that.
I think people called them that long before the Power Rangers. So yeah. I don't think the Power Rangers are just a symptom. They're not the cause.
If only I know. So how did you get interested in animals with big teeth and claws? I mean, is it sort of just because they're big and scary, or is there something else?
I guess so. So I can give you just a little synopsis of like what got me into vertebrate paleontology.
Please do.
I was never one of those kids who loved dinosaurs. I didn't really care about dinosaurs, which makes me a weirdo, but it's true.
No, what?
But I really loved mammals. Like when I was a kid, my folks would take me to the museum, and I would just stare at those taxidermied animals, you know, the ones that always look like deer in headlights in their little dioramas. Right. And you think, like, yes. If you blink and turn away, they might move and, like, change positions in a creepy, dead kind of way. Those are the things I really loved when I was a kid. So I always wanted to work on mammals. And I had no idea I wanted to be a vertebrate paleontologist until I was actually in college. And there was an ad in the school paper. I went to the University of Florida for my undergrad degree. And there was an ad in the school paper for a vertebrate paleontology assistant. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to apply for that. And so I applied.
Were you already studying that stuff? Or was it just like, that sounds cool, and I've taken, you know, my English prereqs or something? I mean,
I was a zoology major. Yes, I was a zoology major.
So you were already in that direction.
Yeah, yes. I knew I liked animals. I just didn't know what I wanted to do with animals.
I see. Okay.
And so as an assistant vertebrate paleontologist, what did you do in that lab?
I actually didn't get hired.
Oh, no. Never mind.
So I didn't get hired. And then I was kind of devastated about that because I thought it was really cool. So I ended up taking a class on it. And then once I took the class, the professor of the class was sort of the head honcho in the vert paleo range. And he decided to hire me because he was impressed with how I did in the class. So once I actually did get hired, I would do things like identify fossils, catalog fossils and put fossils into their correct trays in the museum cabinets.
Well, it's probably harder than it sounds.
It takes a while. I mean, you really have to learn the anatomy, the skeletal anatomy, really well. And on top of that, you have to learn the skeletal anatomy of multiple different species of mammals, because that's mostly what we were dealing with in that collection. And so it took me a long time. It took me years to be able to get good at that and to be able to pick up a bone, a piece of a bone, and say, oh, yeah, that's a piece of a humerus from a big cat. You know, like it takes.
Of course.
It takes time to be able to do that. And so those are the skills that I was building when I worked in the museum as an undergraduate.
That sounds fascinating. So do you have a particular species that is your favorite?
Yeah, I do. So I actually didn't work on big cats until I started my PhD work. I worked on llamas before that, believe it or not.
Wait, llamas have been around? How long have llamas been around?
About 54 million years.
Oh, of course.
Wow, I had no idea that.
Why do we never think of llamas when we think of ancient species?
And what got you, why were llamas your favorite?
Well, they aren't, but I really did like them at the time. My super favorite, though, sorry, I completely got on a tangent there, is okay. Smilodon fatalis, the saber-toothed cat from famous from California.
Smilodon? Is that what the Latin name is?
Yeah, it's the Latin name for the saber-toothed cat. So the one
You're
that...
totally looking it up right now.
You should look it up.
No, wait, so how many different kinds of saber-toothed cats are there?
Oh, there's hundreds? A lot. There's a lot. There's I don't know. I don't have all my books with
me. No, it's okay. So there's more than like one or two.
They've been around for millions of years, and different species have arisen at different times and gone extinct. And Smilodon was one of the ones that made it to the very end. So it was one of the ones that went extinct while there were people around. So Smilodon coexisted with people in North America for several thousands of years.
Do we know why they went extinct?
That's a really good question. And the short answer is no, we don't know for sure. There's some really good hypotheses that have been tested and retested and are pretty strong. They have good support. So the major reason we think why all these things went extinct at the end of the Ice Age, or the Pleistocene as we call it, is climate change. There's just this enormous scale climate change, and the temperatures went up by like 9 degrees Celsius or something within a few hundred or maybe 1,000 years, and it was just a real stressful experience, I think, for everyone involved, from the plants all the way to the carnivores. Additionally, around that time is when we get an influx of people that we know of into North America. And a lot of people think that climate was the main impetus, and that humans just delivered the final blow.
Hmm. Are there lots of specimens of at least this particular cat that you can study, or do you work off of tiny pieces of things?
No way. So there's this site called the Rancho La Brea Tar Pits in Los Angeles. I think there's at least 300 complete skulls of Smilodon in that collection.
Oh, wow.
And just an insane number of postcrania, thousands and thousands of postcranial elements, which are like arms and legs.
Right. But that's not, I mean, I'm just, you know, talking to other folks who study, you know, hominids and, you know, human variations of humans, like, you know, we're so lucky we have one fraction of a piece of a pelvic bone.
Right.
You know, and it's got to be, is it overwhelming to have that many things to work with, or does it make it easier to do research or harder?
It makes it so much easier. I mean, it's overwhelming, but your sample sizes are what you would get if you studied modern animals only. You know, you could probably, there are more skulls of Smilodon in the tar pits than there are skulls of anything living in anything, any mammal that's living still as a species in the Los Angeles County Museum. I mean, unless there's some dormouse or something that has like a million skulls, but
that's a huge difference. I mean, that's
huge. It's huge.
I guess what's your special to your area of specialization, are you more on the excavation side, or are you more on the let's take what we have and analyze it to look at a specific feature?
So I do a little bit of both. I can tell you more about my excavation experience in a minute, but I mostly do functional morphology. So I measure skulls and postcrania, and I figure out what they were doing for a living. So were they climbing? Were they running? What were they eating? And I use that information to recreate the extinct animal's ecology.
And how do you do that?
How do you do that?
With fossils?
Great question. So we use modern analogs, animals that we have around today that we know what they're doing for a living. And we use the measurements of their bones, and then we compare the fossils to the modern species to try to figure out what the fossils were doing. And sometimes it's easy because you've got something that looks a lot like things that are around today. And sometimes it's a lot harder because they don't look like anything that's alive today. And you have to extrapolate and, you know, be creative.
So for Smilodon, what modern animal do you compare it to? I'm assuming it's not a house cat.
No. So we compare it generally to like the living big cats. So lions, tigers, jaguars, things like that, to try to figure out what it's doing. And even though it's similar to those animals, it's really different. It was doing something different than what those animals were doing.
Is there something that would surprise us about big cats that we probably have gotten all wrong in our heads since we were children and called them saber-toothed tigers? Is there something that's like that we always think they all do and they really don't?
I don't know. That's a good question.
They're like, probably were they all vegetarian and we all thought they were meat eaters or something?
No, they are totally meat eaters. They're like 99% meat eaters. Cats are like the most carnivorous mammal alive. Huh. They really don't want anything but meat. They even, like, when they eat an ungulate, when they eat a big wildebeest or something out in the African plain, they will actually, like, squeeze the plant matter out of their intestines while
they don't
want
to eat it.
They don't want it. Yeah. Seriously, like they can eat, their diet is like 99% meat, and they're totally cool with that.
Okay. That wouldn't go well for me being a vegetarian. I could actually coexist pretty well because we wouldn't ever eat the same thing, right?
Right,
they just
right.
Eat you.
Yeah, they eat me.
They would eat you, yeah. Right, right. Yeah, cats are actually, I mean, in the wild, they're, you know, I would be more afraid. Like if I went to Africa and I went out in the field, you don't need to be afraid of the big cats as much as you need to be afraid of, like, hippos.
So, I've heard that about hippos.
Yeah.
They're mean, right?
They're really awful. Hippos and crocodiles. Like, I would never want to get in the way of either of those. So just avoid the water.
Because they're fast, right? They're, like, super fast.
Yeah.
In single direction, right? They can't turn?
No, they can turn.
They
they can turn. They can sprint. Okay. You never want to be caught in the water by any kind of alligator. Oh. That would just be like death instantly.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Note to self.
Julie, you mentioned your excavation experience. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now, I'm actually the principal investigator on a project at this site called Natural Trap Cave in Wyoming. And it's in the Bighorn Mountains in Wyoming, at the base of the Bighorns, and it is a 75-foot deep sinkhole where we actually have to rappel in and ascend out on ropes. But at the bottom of that sinkhole is a site that has tons of Ice Age mammals. So we have skeletons of multiple different species of mammals. We have some carnivores that I love. We also have a lot of herbivores down there, and they basically fell to their death at the during the Ice Age, and they have been preserved for the last, you know, 40 to 12,000 years. And the site is really awesome because they never got trampled, so the bones are really well preserved. And the site is about 40 degrees, even in the summer, 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And in the winter, I'm sure it's colder, so... Again, the bone material is really well preserved. There's a lot of collagen in it. When you do sampling, when you do destructive sampling on those bones, they smell like burning hair. Like, they're just a lot of original material left in them. And so so we're down there, me and my team, and the guy who I'm doing this project with is from Australia, and he's an ancient DNA specialist named Alan Cooper. And so he's looking for ancient DNA in these mammals, and I'm looking at their morphology. And then we're also reconstructing the paleo environment of Ice Age Wyoming.
Is that a heavily studied sort of time frame, or do people not really know anything about it? And is this the first sort of glimpse of that?
Well, it's a pretty well studied time frame, actually. A lot of people are interested in the end of the Pleistocene because we're sort of mimicking that with global warming, with human caused global warming. We're sort of mimicking that end Pleistocene effect. And so people really are interested in that time period. But the reason why this site is so cool is because the record, the fossil record, is amazing. And we also have a record of pollen and of microfauna, so little tiny vertebrates, that basically span the entire range from the last glacial maximum, so the last time it was super cold in North America, to the present. Like, it's an unbroken record. So we've got this amazingly meticulous record from this cave, which is something that's really rare. Usually, you know, you get a good, you know, 1,000-year window or something, but this cave gives us like a 30,000-year window. So we can really look at this stuff.
Where do you even start with that if you know you have so much information there?
That is a good question. It's very overwhelming. Right now we're looking at the animals. We haven't even really started looking at the pollen yet. We know we have pollen, but we're trying to get funding for the pollen work. And that's being done by a collaborator of mine at the University of Wyoming. So we're just starting on the mammals and the little reptiles. And my postdoc is actually working on the microfauna. Along with another collaborator at Georgia Tech, and I'm doing the big mammal stuff. But it's just, there's a lot. It's really hard to know where to start.
So is a lot of your time spent on site then, as opposed to in lab or at the university?
No, I'm actually only there for about a month every year. So between me and my postdoc, Corey, the two of us are there for about a month. And we lead a field crew out, and we go down into the site every day, and we spend all day down there, and then we come up at the end of the day. And when we're done, we just bring all our fossils back to my lab in Des Moines, and we have high school students, actually, and medical students and undergrad students helping us sort and identify the material that we find.
That sounds so awesome.
Yeah, wish I could have done that in high school.
You mentioned that you had to rappel down something feet to escape. How did you prepare for that?
Oh, yeah. I had to. So I had never done this before. My collaborator, Alan, was a serious caver. He's from New Zealand. He's done a lot of caving. And so we thought he would be able to handle like a whole team of noobs going down into the cave, you know, people who had never caved before. Well, that didn't really work out. But luckily, we had this awesome team of cavers that heard about our project and basically volunteered their time to come out and be our safety team. And so we've got this amazing team of cavers from the Northern Rocky Mountain Grotto that come out, and they basically volunteer for days or weeks at a time and just help us with safety. And they've been so amazing and awesome. And basically the only payment they get is that we feed them.
That's
so
good,
they've
though.
Been amazing. And the way I prepared was I went to like a local rock climbing gym. I had bought all my harnesses and you know, equipment. So I basically figured out how the harness and the equipment worked, and I put it on, and they gave me a rope at the rock climbing gym. And I basically figured out how to do the frogging system. That's what they call it. When you ascend up, it's called the frogging system. Because you kind of look like a frog when you're going up. I figured out how to do it, and I was still scared shitless. I don't know if I can say that.
That's okay.
Or not, but and then when I first did it, when I first rappelled down in, I was like, oh, this isn't so bad. And then my first descent was a little scary. It's actually scarier for me going up than down. I don't know why. And then once I made it up the first time, up and down one time, I was like, I got this. This is cool. So I actually really enjoy doing the ascent and the descent. It's really fun.
Now, how did this whole site get found? Was it just some cavers sort of poking around, or did you know that this was a pre-existing site that just hadn't been worked through yet?
Yeah, so it was a pre-existing site. I think it actually was found by cavers, but it was found by cavers in the early 70s or even before that. And it's owned by the Bureau of Land Management, so it's on federal land. And it was like a recreational cave. Cavers used to go in and out. Well, I guess somebody found fossils down there. So the BLM said, well, we can't let people go and recreate in there anymore. We're going to lock it up. So they did. And then this team from the University of Missouri and the University of Kansas got an NSF grant and a National Geographic grant back in 1974. And they did the first excavations. And they excavated for about 11 years there.
Wow.
So they went from 74 to 85, and they excavated a ton of stuff. And all of the stuff that they've found previously is at the University of Kansas Museum. And it's a huge collection. And then they closed up shop in 1985, and no one else went back until we opened it up again in 2014.
So they found all the good stuff, and now you're finding, like, the smaller things? Or is it
your... Yeah, that's pretty much accurate. You got it.
Why are all these species, creatures, all in the same place? Is it like they fell in together, or is it this, was this like a dying place, or was this like a tar pit where they all got stuck? I mean, why here?
It was a dying place. I would say that was probably pretty accurate.
I know, I'm using really sophisticated words here.
Yeah, no. So what happened is, so there's this little ridge. It's in the base of the mountains. And so there's all this lime rock territory, all this limestone territory. And right before you get to the hole, the opening of the cave is only about 20 feet across, as compared to, you know, the 75 foot drop. And then when you go in, it's like a football field open. So it's huge. But when you're coming over this little ridge, you can't really see the hole. And then as soon as you crest the ridge, the hole's just right there. So I'm guessing what happened is, you know, carnivores or herbivores were running. Maybe herbivores were running away from carnivores. And they're full speed, and they crest this hill, and then in they go. So they couldn't really stop. You know, it was like, you know, everybody in. And I'm sure that, like, multiple individuals probably went in at the same time if they were running.
Like the cat chasing the herbivore, and oops, there they both go, and then they're both in there.
Yep. That's my guess, And you know, if they didn't die right away, they would have starved to death. There's no other way out of that cave except for the opening at the top. So there's no way out. Once you're in, even if you manage to survive the fall, you're screwed. So,
that's depressing.
Yeah, it is depressing. So it's depressing to think about. But just I the thing that consoles me is that now they've left their bodies for us to find. You know, tens of thousands of years later. And it's really cool because we can figure out what animals were there based on, you know, what we find in the cave.
I just Wikipedia'd American lion because I'd never heard of that before.
Uh-huh.
Is that related to the African lion?
It is. Yep. It's bigger, though. It's about a third again as big as the African lion.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like, there's estimates of it that think that its maximum weight is around 900 pounds.
Ooh, that's like giant bear size.
Yeah. So, like, that's a kitty I really wouldn't want to meet in a dark alley.
No kidding. Oh, man. So what, speaking of really wanting to meet things, what's the coolest discovery you've made in not just in this cave, but all over? Is there a certain skeleton or a certain fragment that you found that just sort of blew your mind, or just you're really excited about?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. So when I was in, when I was at Florida, and I was working in the museum, we went on this dig at this site called Hale, H-A-I-L-E, not hell, but Hale. And, it was a limestone quarry, or a phosphate mine, something like that. Like, they were mining something there. And they knew that there was a site, a fossil mammal site there. And I forgot the age. I think it might have been Pliocene, which is older than Pleistocene. It's like 3 million years old. But I can't be, I don't remember for sure. But I will tell you that we found a new species of ground sloth there that was enormous, bigger than almost anything that we had found in North America before. And
a sloth?
A ground sloth. Yeah. 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 Not a tree sloth, a ground sloth.
Are they like sort of similar looking, just gigantic?
Yes. Yes.
I'm oh my God. The first image is terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we found one of the biggest, if you Google Florida ground sloth, you'll actually find the name of it. I forgot the name of it. But it was enormous, and we were the team that found the first one of those. And so I was part of the team that found that sloth.
Did you know what you were looking at when you found it?
Yeah, we did. We did. Because we knew sloths were in the area at the time. And so, you know, when you first uncover a bone like that, you know it's something big. You have a good idea of what it could be. It could have been like something related to a mammoth. It would be too old to be a mammoth, but it could have been a mastodon or a shovel tusk gomphothere, which is like this weird looking elephant thing. And it could be a ground sloth.
So much today.
so when we found it, we knew it was a ground sloth by the look of the bones. But it was really an amazing site to be at because so many fossils came out of that site, and the ground sloth was just amazing. And then the other cool thing that I found was when I was in my grad career, I was in my PhD, and I worked at this site called Hagerman Fossil Beds National Monument in Idaho. I worked there in the summer with my ex-husband, who was also a paleontologist and still is. But the two of us together found this jaw of a bear that was incredible. And it ended up belonging to a species of bear that was thought to have gone extinct in North America like 2 million years before we found it. So we pushed the record of that bear back by like 2 million years.
Wow.
Or forward. So that was super exciting.
So I'm going to ask a question that's going to get a little bit wonkier. Sure. Not that we haven't been before. I just kind of want to know how you differentiate a fossil between species when you look at it. Because, you know, I look at something and I'm like, okay, that's there. But, like, how do you tell whether it's going to be a mastodon or a sloth or a elephant or a lion or any of these things?
So that's a good question. The first thing is that you have to really know your osteology, your bone anatomy, really well. So you have to know the difference between, you know, your arm bone, a humerus, and your leg bone, a femur. You have to know what the difference is between all of these different bones. So that's step one. Step two is more complicated. You actually have to use comparative modern collections. So you look at the bones of a modern cat and the bones of a modern dog and the bones of a modern elephant, and you say, okay, now I know what a humerus looks like in a cat and a dog and an elephant. And then, on top of all of that, you need to know approximately what time period you're looking at to give you a baseline of what kinds of animals were there. So you've got to have all that information together. And then you should be able to identify different bones from different species of fossil mammals.
What kind of gets you excited about this area for the next 5-10 years? Like, what's kind of the thing that you're looking forward to or hope to see?
Ooh, I am really excited about trying to find dire wolf DNA. I don't do ancient DNA myself, but I collaborate with several people that do ancient DNA, and I would really love it if we could find dire wolf DNA. I also would like to do more projects with coyotes. I did a project on coyotes a couple of years ago, and I really think they're fascinating and I love them. So those are the things I think I'd really like to do.
Wait, I want to talk about dire wolves.
Wait, I'm okay. Like, those are real?
Yeah, they're real.
I know.
They're real.
They're not just figments of George R. R. Martin's imagination.
No, right. They are actually a real species from the Pleistocene that went extinct at the end of the Ice Age. They actually coexisted with Smilodon. They were like arch nemeses.
Of course they were.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a TV series in here somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So wait, so are there, do you guys have specimens of the of dire wolves where you just don't have the DNA? Or is just not, it's not like they may have existed. They existed. We have their bones.
Right.
We just don't have their DNA.
Right, you know how many Smilodon skulls I told you they have at the tar pits?
Yeah.
They have more dire wolf skulls than that.
Whoa.
How do at the tar pits. How is this not like on the New York Times?
I don't know. I don't know. Like, we're gonna make it happen. I think this stuff is so cool.
Okay.
So, yeah, I would love to get direwolf DNA. Nobody's gotten any yet. So nobody knows what their genome looks like or their molecular data.
We don't have the technology to extract the DNA, or there just haven't been any DNA samples to get?
I think it's more the latter. We do have the technology to extract the DNA. There's been successful ancient DNA gotten from actually my collaborator, Alan. He's extracted DNA from the American cheetah, the American lion, extinct horses, extinct bison. But the problem with direwolves is that nobody has a good sample that DNA can be extracted from. Turns out that all of the fossils at the tar pits are terrible for getting DNA out of because they clean the fossils because of all the tar, the petroleum that's in them. They clean them with petroleum products like gasoline and kerosene and other things like that. And that stuff basically kills the DNA. Like it just ruins it. And so none of those tar pit specimens have been successfully sequenced. Doesn't mean it won't happen eventually, but they haven't been yet. And we just haven't found a good specimen for dire wolves.
What's the theory? What's the going theory for them? Are they related to our current canine friends, or are they more related to cats? I mean, what is the...
They're dogs. They're solid dogs. They're probably... So all the morphological evidence suggests that they are the sister species to the living gray wolf. They are really... They look just like a... They look so much like a gray wolf. They're more robust, they're bigger, you know, they're made for cracking bones of big animals.
Of course they are.
But they really do, I mean, they're a wolf. They're without a doubt a wolf. And
just large wolves.
Right. They are a native North American wolf, which is different than the gray wolf that we have around today, which is native to Eurasia. Hmm. So the dire wolf is a true American wolf.
It's American. There we go. Julie, thank you so much for agreeing to be on our show. This was fascinating stuff.
Thanks.
And I will never call it a saber-toothed tiger ever again.
Just call it a saber-toothed cat.
Saber-toothed cat.
Yeah.
I promise. All
right. Okay. Okay.
Thanks, Julie.
Thank you very much. This was fun.
Like our show? Find us on iTunes or at scopepodcast.com. And follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Mumu Shu
and Lindsay Claiborne.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycats. Thanks for listening.